Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam, 3rd canto, chapter 8, Manifestation of Brahma from Vishnu, text 3. Āsīnam urbhyām bhagavantam ājaṁ Sankarshanam devam akuntha sattam Vivitsavas tatramatha parasya Kumara mukhya munayon vaprachan Some time ago, being inquisitive to know, Sanat Kumar, the chief of the boy saints, accompanied by other great sages, inquired exactly like you about the truths requiring Vasudeva, the Supreme, from Lord Sankarshan, who is seated at the bottom of the universe. Purport. This is in clarification of the statement that the Lord spoke directly on the Srimad Bhagavatam. When and unto whom the Bhagavatam was spoken is explained herewith. Questions similar to those put forward by Vidura were asked by great sages like Sanat Kumar, and Lord Sankarshan, the plenary expansion of the Supreme Lord Vasudeva, answered them. Om Gyana Chimarandasya Gyananjana Shlakaya Chakshum Litam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nishananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasavi Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. This chapter of Bhagavatam is describing how Brahma appeared from Garbhadakshai Vishnu. It may sound a little fantastic to your senses, but just think about what you are forced to believe according to the materialistic conception of life. You're forced to believe that matter has inconceivable potencies, achintya shakti. Instead of looking for the achintya shakti in the spiritual energy and the source of that spiritual energy, you look for the achintya shakti, the inconceivable potency, in matter. And therefore you force yourself into the very crazy position of having all kinds of abnormal expectations from inert matter. You become convinced that matter can do the impossible just given enough time. The Bhagavatam describes that everything comes from the Supreme Life. Without spirit, matter can't do anything. And that Supreme Spirit, Krishna, is the unlimited source of intelligence, artistry, personal qualities, attractiveness. Therefore, when the expansion of Krishna as one of the Purusha avatars at the bottom of the universe, Garbhadakshai Vishnu decides to manifest the first living entity, Brahma. He does so in the most artistic way, from his lotus navel. Why is the Lord described as having a lotus navel? Because it's so beautiful. It resembles a lotus flower. You can look at your navel and see how beautiful it is. then imagine someone so beautiful that their navel is described as, you know, being lotus-like. From that lotus navel of Garbhadaksha Vishnu comes a lotus flower. And Lord Brahma is manifested from that lotus flower. A beautiful way to take birth. Still, it's a material birth. It is not a spiritual birth. Everything comes from the Supreme Lord, spirit and matter. For Krishna, everything is spirit, but he makes his spiritual energy act in different ways. So the spiritual energy acts like matter. You cannot artificially say that everything is spirit when Krishna has his spiritual energy, part of it, acting as a matter. But for Krishna, everything is all his spiritual energy. But the way that spiritual energy is acting in the material world is different than how it acts in the spiritual world. The example always given is that to an electrician or electrical engineer at the power plant, he's simply dealing with electrical energy. But when that electrical energy comes into your home, it can produce heat or it can produce coolness. But to the power plant engineer, it's all electricity. But in your home, you feel the air conditioner or you feel the heater. Similarly to Krishna, all his energy is spiritual, but it acts in different ways according to the situation of the person. Brahma is known as Atmabhu and Swayambhu because his birth is without the need of a mother. Krishna is independent, so in his Purusha avatar expansion, he gives rise to Brahma, the first living entity, without having to take recourse to anyone else. Once again, showing that the Supreme Absolute Truth is completely independent. Everyone likes art in this world, in some way or another. Krishna is the supreme artist. Why do we want to deny him that attribute of artistry? If you know anyone who's an artist, you know they like to do everything with creativity and flair. Just like Sri Yashoda will tell you that she sees colors everywhere. Color possibilities, artistic possibilities. You're also like that, William, or you're not so much of an artist? Huh? Yeah, your mother's like that. That comes from Krishna, who has the unlimited artistic abilities. Why is it that we want to deny these things in the Supreme Absolute Truth and make God so boring? It's out of envy we do that. We want to make God so boring so that we'll feel that we're very exciting. God has no artistry. God has no adventure. God has no romance. But we have all these things. Sometimes you see these tour buses for young backpackers going around. Kiwi Adventure. So, yes. As I was coming on the airplane from Singapore, there were so many young people from England. You know, they had their, you know, their sightseeing books, Lonely Planet's Guide to New Zealand, or the rough Guide to New Zealand, or whatever. They're all looking for adventure. Now, why do you want to deny that in the Supreme Absolute Truth? Where else can it come from? Your little desire for adventure. It comes from the Supreme Adventure. Where else can your desire for romance come from? Except from the Supreme Romantic Person. Out of envy, we want to deny in the Supreme Absolute Truth all the things that we'd like to do for ourselves. We want adventure, artistry, romance, but God cannot have that. This is our way of indirectly striking back at the Supreme Absolute Truth. You can't have, it's for me. It's all part of our rebellious spirit of being in the material world. My life will be full of adventure, artistry, romance. But the Absolute Truth, very boring subject matter. Therefore, no one's interested. Who would ever think that Krishna has a lifestyle? Who would ever think that the Supreme Absolute Truth has a lifestyle? No, everyone's concerned with their own lifestyle. It should be very exciting and satisfying and interesting. But as far as the source of all energy, as far as the supreme reservoir of everything, who knows? No individuality, no personality, just what is, and doesn't have to concern us because we have our own very wonderful lives to play with. But when we contemplate Lord Vishnu giving birth to Lord Brahma, all our conceptions about the Supreme Absolute Truth are shattered. We can see that the Lord does everything in the most extraordinary way. And you're not even talking about the original personality of Godhead. You're talking about an expansion of an expansion of an expansion of an expansion. Krishna does not directly deal with the material world, but he will directly deal with his devotees. The maintenance of the material world is entrusted to the Purusha avatars, the Vishnu expansions. Krishna, the original personality of Godhead, does not deal with maintaining the material world. But he will deal personally with his devotees in the material world. That is the amazing thing. This chapter begins with Maitreya Muni, the great sage, glorifying the family of Vidura. Because the family of Vidura, that's who he's speaking to, was always devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And by Vidura's efforts to hear about Krishna, he's making the transcendental pastimes of the Lord become newer and newer at every moment. This is the amazing thing about hearing and chanting the glories of Lord Krishna. Each time you try to enter deeper into the mystery of the Lord's activities and qualities, those activities and qualities become sweeter and sweeter. Krishna's glories are never stable. They never get stagnant. they're always increasing in sweetness and freshness. By your efforts to relish them, their sweetness increases. In the material world, by your efforts to enjoy something, it becomes depleted, worn out, exhausted. You can see that in any material activity you try to do. You wear yourself out, and you wear the thing out that you're trying to enjoy. That's why, as we said so many times, you look at young people today, and by the time they're 21, they're completely depleted and exhausted from trying to enjoy so much sex life in their youth. They don't understand that they're destroying their own energies. They simply become caught up in the body and its passionate stimulations. They don't understand you have to pay a price for that. Anytime you try to interact with the material energy for your own purposes, you pay the price of depletion. Everything material is limited. And you pay a price. These material bodies are limited. Whatever you do with them, you pay a price for. There's no free lunches in the material world. It's like yesterday, Mihoko was telling me, "So, I will go to Japan and you'll come visit the devotees in Japan." I said, "I cannot do so much traveling. What do you want out of me?" "But all the devotees want that you come." I said, "How much can I do?" So I told him, "You must promise to come visit here once a year." We are spirit soul, but we're operating in this material world with a material body. That means limitation. You can't just do this and that and not pay a price. Just like traveling. Traveling means you pay a price. You lose energy. Your bodily airs become disturbed by so much airplane travel. Your skin becomes dry because the atmosphere inside the airplane. So many effects are there. Whatever you do, you become depleted. And you have to take counteractive measures. Otherwise, you'll be depleted to zero. Similarly, so many young men and women, they become fascinated by their bodies at the time of puberty. And because there's no more restraint in today's culture, in fact, with the encouragement of their parents, they just indulge in the body. Why not? Nothing else to do. We are the body. They don't understand that they're expending their energies. They're depleting their physical and mental capacity. Then you can see by the time they're 21, they look so wasted, like dried prunes. They're so foolish, they think, "Oh, we're having a good time." It's like driving a car. You may think, "I'll drive at a high speed, it'll be so much fun." But when you drive at a high speed, especially when you stop and you start and you stop and you start, you're expending so much petrol. But the foolish person thinks, "Oh, we're simply driving at a high speed, stopping and starting, stopping and starting." Sometimes you see people at red lights. When the light turns green, they roar away, you know, making their tires screech. They don't understand. They're paying a price. They're destroying their tires. They're using up so much petrol, all that sudden acceleration. But they just get fascinated by the feeling. Burning rubber. Any of you guys did that? Chris used that. What was the feeling you got? Burning rubber. What was that feeling? Power, right?
The acceleration and back in the seat.
So what's the difference between that and sex life? Same thing, the power of acceleration. You can feel macho, right? And you pay a price. Bodily breakdown. Just like when you roar away from a red light with a car, screeching the tires, and you're burning the rubber. But under the mode of ignorance, you know, people think that's a cool thing. They definitely call it burning rubber. You might even drive back to the spot where you left to see if there were any tire marks on the road. Did you do that? You're destroying your car, but you're proud of it. What a feeling of, you know, this is the mode of ignorance. Passionate ignorance. Similarly, people engage in sex life and they think, oh, the thrill, the surge of energies, the feeling of passion flowing through you, the magic moment, just like when you race away from a red light. But you're destroying yourself. But the fools don't see that. You simply have to adjust your vision to see what's actually going on. So you pay a price for everything you do in this world. That's why you have to think carefully about what you do and why you're doing it. If everything belongs to Krishna, if you can understand that, because everything does belong to Krishna, if you can understand that, you'll be very careful about how you use Krishna's energy. You'll be very careful about how you use the energy of your life. Because actually, you're part of Krishna. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Mamaivam sho jiva loke, jiva bhuta sanatana. All you living entities are my eternal parts. But because you're in the oppressive material atmosphere, you're struggling. Manasasthani Indiani Prakatistani Garshiji. You're struggling with your senses in the oppressive material atmosphere. What is that struggle about? It's about taking a body and giving up the body and for a few moments trying to enjoy some pleasure amidst the process of taking bodies and giving them up. This is called Prakatistani Garshiji. Now some people will say, oh, you're looking at it all negatively. That means that they're like people who, you know, accelerate when the light turns from red to green and they just overlook the destructive effects in their car and they focus on the thrill, the acceleration, as Chris was saying, being thrown back into your seat. The ego feeling of getting ahead of all the other cars very quickly. You made an effect in the world. You left some tire marks on the road. So, often people say like that. Well, this is the way you're looking at things. It's looking at it in a negative way. The fact is, whatever way you look at life, it is temporary. But the fools want to focus on some flickering sensations. Be positive. Meditate on the flickering sensation. Even if you want to meditate seriously on the flickering sensation, you can't, because it goes so quickly and you go so quickly. So we're not being negative, we're being practical. We're trying to teach people a completely different vision, and they often protest. Oh, you're just being negative. Just like Ojasri's play about Kali Yuga. It's just the negative things. Some people might think. Of course, you should remember next time you have plays that you're going to put so much trouble into practicing. When it's time for the play, you should make sure that people can hear what you say. Well, that's what they use. I keep saying this over and over again. You have to make it so people can hear what you're saying. You have to learn how to project your voice or have a better sound system for everyone. Otherwise, you might hear yourself, but no one else hears clearly. We cannot just do things mechanically for Krishna's service, going through the motions or not using our full intelligence. We must be aware of what we are doing and how to improve it. Not just lock on to something and then do it without thinking. Sometimes devotees can become like that. A bit robot-like, not in the way that materialists accuse us of, but in a devotional way, they become a little like a robot. In that they're not sensitive enough to Krishna. So this is a different thing than the false charge of materialists that, oh, they're a robot, they get up the same time every morning, they do this the same thing, they chant the same mantra. No, we're not speaking about that. Totally baseless accusation. Just like on Gaur Purnima, one girl from Canada had come and she was very interested. But I asked her what are her fears, and she said, well, looks a little bit culty. I said, oh, you mean the materialistic cult that you're in? In which you just admitted you have no idea who you are, you don't know what the goal of life is, you have no idea what you should be doing. You mean that cult, huh? Naturally, our hearts are full of compassion seeing people suffer in such a way. They're very determined to be fools. This is what you're dealing with. People are very determined to be fools. Why are we trying to help them? Because of compassion. Like robots, they just engage in sense gratification and trying to make money and think that's all that's required. sometimes they say, God has given us these bodies to enjoy. Why do you assume that? Better to say, and more accurate to say, God has given us these bodies because of our foolish, independent desire to try and enjoy. But we're not enjoying. There's another way of looking at the body. This body is just a bag of diseases that are waiting to manifest. Oh, negative. Oh, why do you look at it that way? Focus on the nice stimulations and feelings the body can give you. It's all about how you look at things. It's like I had done a program at Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. About 200 people came. And so after I spoke, some students came up for dialogue. And they were presenting to me, you know, because I had spoke about time and stress. So, you know, time is all how you look at it. If you want to be negative about it, it'll be negative. If you want to be positive, it'll be positive. It all just depends on how you look at it. You just got to be with it, you know, and go with whatever it is, you know, and just be positive. So they went on and on like this. So finally I just looked at them. Their leader was one girl student who was, you know, very expressive. It's just, you know, it's just the flow of time. It's what you make it. Just be with it and just, you know, whatever it is, and be positive. And all the other students were nodding their heads, you know, like she was speaking profound wisdom. So finally, I just stopped her and I said, look, tell me, what is the goal of life? She kind of looked at me in shock. What is the goal of life? You know, how could you ask? She was reacting like, how could you ask such a silly question? Everyone knows the answer. What's the goal of life? She just looked at me. And then all her friends were poised, went ready for her answer, waiting for her answer. So then, in a typical feminist way, she kind of threw back her head of red hair. The goal of life is to eat pizza. And all the students cheered. Yeah! This is their proud moment. This is what you have today. People proud to be animals. Spending so much money on university education just to be animals. They don't deny it. So those are the robots. I remember when I was younger, there was a popular song, which, you know, which all the city people really liked. It was called Sex Machine. So people would, young people would go around telling each other, oh, I'm a sex machine. It was a very popular, you know, record. So everyone would just kind of, you know, when they write the graffiti on the wall, they would write so-so, John, sex machine, or on the walls of the city. So, these are the robots. But they think that devotional life is, that's the robot existence. They don't understand the varieties of, that are tasted in devotional service. Now when we say amongst ourselves that sometimes neophyte devotees can be a little robot-like, it's a completely different thing. What does it mean? It means that they're being a little insensitive in their service to Krishna. They're starting to get a bit, callous. Just mechanically chanting their japa, mechanically doing their service. Certainly there's eternal benefit in that, but there's much more benefit to be had if we consciously focus on how to please Krishna. It's like here at the Gaur Yoga Center. Every once in a while I notice the tendency starts to creep in to lock into a routine and just do things without thinking. So then I always try to shake the rug a bit to keep the voice from, you know, hardening. You were doing the same program, same thing every day, so time to turn off the brain, turn off the sensitivity, and just, you know, make everything a routine. Routines don't have to mean mechanical. A routine can be very scintillating and lively. That is what Krishna consciousness bhakti yoga is meant to be. People automatically, when they hear the word routine, think it means just lifelessness and boredom and monotony and no zip and zap. But a routine, a proper routine in Krishna consciousness, can be full of tastes and variegated experiences. So we're not afraid of routine. In fact, the more regulated your life is, the better. The more you can regulate your eating and sleeping, the better. But what we don't want is, while doing our routine, that we become insensitive, not thinking at every moment how to act for Krishna's pleasure, but just kind of flying the plane on automatic pilot. You know yourself that in ordinary human relationships, no one likes to be dealt with in a way of callousness and insensitivity. Many of you had relationships which became like that, and everyone knew it's time to call it quits. Then you come up with some excuse how to end the relationship. Because you don't detect the sensitivity from the other person, or you're not willing to give sensitivity. So then you just say, hey, I think this thing has run its course. Or what are some of the ways you say it? How do you get out of it? What do you say? What do people say? Do you know, Julie? What do they say?
It's just not working.
It's just not working. Anyone else? What do they say?
It's not you, it's me.
It's not you, it's me. You know, you take all the blame on yourself as you walk out the door. It's not you, it's me. I'm just not worthy of you. You're just too much of a nice person, you know? I mean,
Anyone ever said anything like that? What else? What did the guy say?
Just drifted apart.
You just drifted apart, huh? Meaning, you got another girlfriend. Rarely does a man let go of a girl unless he's got something else, because, you know, it has to be the sense object, you know? So, you know, I mean, there's always somebody else. So they drop the old sense object and take the new sense object. What else? You know any Milton? Got to take a business trip, huh? Yeah, got a job offer somewhere else. What about you, Tim? What would you
do? Die for a change.
Die for a change. That means you had your eyes on something else, right? So in this way, everyone is very sensitive about, you know, the liveliness of their relationships. They don't want the relationships to become habitual and insensitive. We should be more concerned about our relationship with Krishna. Our relationship with Krishna manifests through devotional service. That's why Maitreya is complimenting Vidura, that the way you are serving Krishna, your attempts at serving Krishna are making the glories of Krishna fresher and fresher, newer and newer. So we don't want devotees to kind of lock in to a certain pattern, and that pattern becomes the everything. You're supposed to lock in to Krishna's pleasure, and Krishna's pleasure becomes the everything. That's why it's good to ventilate things from time to time, let some fresh air blow in. That's why it's always good to have challenges in devotional service, to keep you from being insensitive and hardened in your execution of devotional service. A devotee is always thinking, how can I be more sensitive to Krishna? What can I do to be more of an instrument in Krishna's service? How can I become more attentive to Krishna's needs? Now, Krishna's independent. He doesn't have needs, but we need to recognize what it is that Krishna wants, what it is that Krishna requires. In the next verse, Maitreya says to Vidura, let me now begin speaking on the Bhagavat Purana, which was directly spoken to the great sages by the personality of Godhead, for the benefit of those who are entangled in extreme miseries for the sake of very little pleasure. Just think about that last phrase and apply it to yourself. Entangled in extreme miseries for the sake of very little pleasure. So this is not being negative, this is being realistic. There is some pleasure in material life, but it's so tiny it's not really worth talking about to anyone who is sane. By anyone who is sane. Why is there some tiny pleasure in material life? Because it's the shadow reflection of spiritual life which is ananda, unlimited pleasure. The shadow has something of the original substance. It's like you can see there, Jeff standing against the wall, and he's got a shadow next to him. So that, now you don't have to move your hand, you're already making a shadow. So that shadow has something of his form. So you can't deny there's nothing. You can't say there's nothing there. There's something there, but it's so insubstantial. It's not worth talking about. Material life, however, means you'll go through so much labor, so much endeavor, just to taste that very little pleasure. This is not being negative. The Bhagavatam is training you to get the full perspective on life, to see it in its entirety. But people aren't used to this. They're not used to thinking deeply. They're not used to seeing that life is a process of taking on bodies and giving them up. It's like a film strip. They don't see the whole film strip. They just see one frame. And in that one frame, they just look at some tiny pleasurable experiences without thinking the frame is going to pass. So their whole vision becomes frozen on certain sensations, and they can't see the whole stream of life. That's why in Bhagavad Gita it is explained that when you're bewildered by the mode of passion and ignorance, you lose all power to understand your stay in this present body. You can't understand it. You can think about your material life and see how you were going through so much just to get a little bit of pleasure. It's so little that we say no pleasure. But if you want to get into the fine print, it's a tiny bit there. So just analyze your life, your material life, and you can see how you're going through so much just to get a tiny bit of pleasure. Now we ask you to become purified in Krishna consciousness. Change your vision completely. Keep yourself pure, keep yourself antiseptic, and then you'll be able to understand what life is about. Stay away from the mode of passion, and you'll be able to see clearly. Now in today's verse, we find that Bhagavatam questions have been posed to Lord Sankarshan, who is seated at the bottom of the universe. How can you say there's no Lord Sankarshan at the bottom of the universe? Who has been to the bottom of the universe? Even if you have, what makes you think that your limited eyes can see everything that goes on at the bottom of the universe? Maitreya is telling Vidura that the same questions you're asking have also been asked by your predecessors. In this way, Maitreya is showing how the disciplic succession operates. Some time ago, being inquisitive to know Sanat Kumar, the chief of the boy saints, the four Kumars, accompanied by other great sages, inquired exactly like you about the truths regarding Vasudeva, the Supreme. And who did he ask? Lord Sankarshan, seated at the bottom of the universe. Bhagavatam is a body of knowledge that is spoken and re-spoken. Not exactly in the same way. The gist is the same, but according to time and place, it is elaborated upon. Just like we explained about the accordion. Whether the accordion is closed or opened up, it's still the same accordion. Similarly, the Bhagavatam knowledge sometimes is presented as kernels. Just like Brahma heard the Bhagavatam, the whole Bhagavatam in four verses, chapter sloki, from the Lord. But those four verses are expanded into 18,000 for us. But Brahma understood the whole thing in four verses. So the Bhagavatam is a body of knowledge that's presented and represented with artistic variation. But it's the same gist, the same essence. And by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, your material desires decrease. Your vision of existence expands. And your love of Krishna becomes revived. That's why Rupa Goswami says that hearing Bhagavatam is one of the five principal procedures for inducing ecstatic love of Krishna. All right, any questions?
Pretty much you were saying that when you sense the earth's been canceled, you try and help the sensitivity. Is there some way you can do that yourself?
Yes, constantly increase your sensitivity to the holy name. That's the first thing. Always be aware of your chanting. And don't become don't feel discouraged because you just can't seem to chant Hare Krishna well enough. You're always going to feel like that. Lord Chaitanya says that's the way it is. He says, Lord Chaitanya, he's the perfect devotee. He says, I'm so unfortunate. I have no attachment, no raga for the holy name. Keep trying, then don't be discouraged. Oh, it's impossible. I just can't. No. By your effort, you enter deeper and deeper into the ocean of the holy name. But you always feel, I just can't get enough. I'm not getting enough. So you keep on going, deeper and deeper. That's why sometimes, I know you've all had that experience, sometimes you're caught by surprise. In spite of what you consider to be your paltry efforts at chanting, suddenly Krishna catches you off guard and you become drowned in an ocean of delight. Hey, what's going on? It actually works. Also, besides being sensitive to chanting, if you want to be effective at giving Krishna to others, you always have to see how you can put more of your heart into what you're doing. We guard our hearts very jealously. But you can't preach, you can't distribute Krishna consciousness without putting your heart into it. So, I always like to see here at the Gaur Yoga Center that devotees are becoming heartfelt preachers. Not just kind of expanding on the mental platform, but putting their hearts into what they're doing, putting their hearts into helping others. I've noticed in New Zealand that one of the national traits is that everyone actually guards their hearts very jealously. They can be very generous on the mental plane, but the hearts are like, we keep it kind of a bit guarded, you know. So there's a lot of bubbling on the mental plane, you know, there's sharing and giving and taking, but you know, the hearts are guarded very closely. We don't want to do that here. We don't want this to be New Zealand here or whatever. We want this to be the Vaikuntha atmosphere. So therefore, don't be afraid to put your hearts into what you're doing, and don't be afraid to put your hearts into helping others. As you become older devotees, more dedicated devotees, you're going to need to learn how to deal with wounds to your heart in Krishna's service. That's the austerity of preaching. That's why Krishna says, no one's more dear to me than the one who preaches my glories. Preaching means trying to help others in Krishna consciousness means it's not always going to be appreciated. You'll be disappointed. You may be let down. You may even be falsely blamed. It's an austerity. So you have to learn how to revive your heart in Krishna consciousness. So there's two things. Putting the heart into helping others and knowing how to revive your heart. That's the art of preaching. All based on knowledge, of course. Krishna consciousness combines the head and the heart. So we always want to generate an increase in the heart energies. That's what attracts people. That's how we can help them the most. Not that we just habitually buzz around on the mental plane, but some of you have to become courageous to preach from the heart and reach out from the heart, knowing that Krishna will sustain you. So when we start getting into these kind of things, then that's the real action in bhakti. Once we get beyond the jealously guarding the heart stage, then life gets exciting. Then people become very attracted to what we're doing because they see such a display of heart energy. Any other questions? Yes?
Maharaj, due to a certain body nature or general feelings, the material world may be exposed to a fair bit of the motivation. So how do we try and steer clear more of the motivation?
cultivate at least the mode of goodness, regulated life, steer clear of passionate activities. Associate with those who are trying to escape the grip of passion. Engage your energies in Krishna's service. They'll become purified that way. Outside of Krishna's service, your energies will not become purified. They will not produce any benefit for you. Learn how to consult others. Generally, passionate people never consult anyone except other passionate people. What do you think about this? This looks good, huh? Yeah. I think you should go for it. Okay? Get into the habit of consulting those who are not in the mode of passion, and then you won't make mode of passion decisions. But the usual response is, number one, to consult other passionate people, or number two, not to consult anyone and just, you know, consult your own passionate mind. What do you think, mind? Oh, yeah. Looks okay. Okay, I consulted my mind. Anything else? Yes? What's that?
You talked about having resolvement of the image for their own self-life.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find a balance between putting your heart into service and immediately trying to put some service and using up those energies for them too much?
Using up those energies for?
Oh,
Every body is different, so you have to see for yourself how you can make a schedule so that you're productive. Because each person's body is different. It's like learning how to ride a bicycle. Don't be discouraged that, you know, the first few times you fall off the bicycle. You remember what it was like when you were a little kid learning how to ride a bike? It took some time, right? You didn't give up, did you? Yeah, but at some point you took the training wheels off, right? And you probably tumbled a few times, right? All right. But you were possessed with the goal of learning how to ride a bike. So bodies are different. Gradually, in Krishna consciousness, you develop the lifestyle skills for how to manage your life in a way that's harmonious with your individual characteristics. There's some basic things that are common for everyone. If you're working and your work is helping to spread Krishna consciousness, don't be so mentally intimidated by the work. Hmm. gradually you can learn how to flow easily back and forth between work and your home life, work and your home life, and like that. It'll happen. A problem that neophyte devotees have who are working is that, you know, they come across Krishna consciousness and all of a sudden, you know, their working world looks totally useless and No, you have to learn how to go back and forth between the two. If you're working, is maintaining at least yourself, that's something. If that self is engaged in devotional service, and much better, much more, if your working is helping to spread Krishna consciousness, then don't have such an attitude of being intimidated. Don't have such an averse attitude. Just flow back and forth between the different worlds. Main thing is this mental attitude, which is wrong. If your work is helping for Krishna's pleasure, why have this averse attitude? Just do your job and take care of your spiritual life. No need to be so mental about it. Make a schedule that you can cope with and leave it at that. It's not a big deal. Anything else? Yes?
How do you know how
do
you
show
that your
father and dad are It's enlivening to the father to have children who ask, you know, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing it the right way? Naturally, if you're trying to please someone, you want to hear from that person that things are going on in the right way. That's all part of sensitivity. I ask how you're feeling. So it's a two-way street. Anything else? You read Bhagavad Gita, you know the symptoms. But if you are following the process of devotional service properly, you're actually not affected by the mode of passion. Prabhupada gives the example of someone who's in a boat and the waves may be fierce and they're rocking the boat, but they're not rocking the person. It's something outside of you. But if you identify with what's outside of you, you might think, I'm rocking. It's actually the boat that's rocking. Once a devotee asked Prabhupada that, you know, in the third canto of Bhagavatam, Lord Kapila Dev describes devotional service and passion, goodness and ignorance. You've read that section? So the devotee asked, does this apply to your disciples? Prabhupada looked at him and said, who is my disciple? And then the devotee thought, and he said, well, one who follows your instructions. So does this apply? Prabhupada said, no. It's not that a devotee who's following properly gets affected by the mode of passion. It's just that you can act in a certain way according to past habits, which can resemble the mode of passion. But if you're immersed in sadhana bhakti properly, you're not affected by the mode of passion. So we always have to keep ourselves properly situated. The endeavor to keep yourself properly situated is the preliminary sign that love of Krishna is manifesting in you. That effort to be properly situated is not an ordinary thing. Don't become, don't take it lightly. Sometimes you may think, oh, how many years is it going to be like this where every day I have to see if I'm properly situated? That's the beginning of love. If you didn't do that, it means you didn't care. But when you care, you're wondering, am I properly situated? Am I doing the right, am I doing things properly? That's a preliminary, that's the tip of the iceberg of love. Krishna consciousness is very emotional, and part of the emotional experience is thinking, am I properly situated? So there may be things buzzing around you, but it doesn't mean you have to identify with it all. Just like what does Krishna explain in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Apuryamanam achalat pratista samudyamapa pravashanti yadvat. Just like so many rivers pour into the ocean, but the ocean doesn't overflow its limits. Similarly, desires, material desires, may come to the devotee endeavoring for self-realization, but the devotee is not capsized by these things. Why? Because the devotee is full in devotional service. So these things may bounce around your perimeters, but they don't capsize you. You understand? If you scientifically analyze your existence, you can see right now there's so many things that may bounce around outside you, but when you're properly situated in devotional service, they don't capsize you. There may be things buzzing around. Sometimes you feel like things are buzzing around in your own body and mind, but because you're properly situated in devotional service, your spiritual life is not capsized. Have you noticed that? What is a proper situation? The proper situation is that you're executing sadhana bhakti. If you want more specific guidance, you ask your spiritual master. That's one way of analyzing proper situation. That's the most important way. Then there's subordinate ways. How your lifestyle is. What your ashram situation is, what your living situation is. But that's all subordinate to the situation of your execution of devotional service, sadhana bhakti. because regardless of whatever your lifestyle situation is, you're going to have to execute sadhana bhakti. So that's the most important thing.